Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 720 a.m. in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. We'll be here till 5 a.m. And now we will take a little stroll. We'll go down the stairs, turn the corner, go down a secret hallway, and say the secret word and give the secret handshake, and walk into the Pop Culture Club with one of the founding members, one of the golden card holders of the Pop Culture Club, Mick Kaler. How you doing there, Mick?
I'm doing great, pal. How about yourself?
Very good. Now, explain to the uninitiated why we call this. I'm playing Karma Chameleon as the intro to this segment, and explain why I'm playing Karma Chameleon.
Well, Karma Chameleon is a hit song in the 80s from a group called Culture Club. Culture Club with Boy George, okay? And you and I talk about pop culture.
And oops.
Can you hear me now?
There you go. He's back.
We're a phone commercial. Yeah, we're Pop Culture Club, as you explained. Culture Club, the band. And we have a little club between us
right.
And our little secret hideaway, as you said, in the basement. We're right past the washing machine and the laundry sink. And we close the door. Girls are allowed, by the way.
That's true. Icky girls are allowed.
That's right. They're icky, but they are allowed.
Yeah, right. But, yeah, so Mick and I just, we've always been into pop culture, and we met each other back in, my goodness, the mid to early 80s when we both went to Elmhurst College. We were both on the radio station in college. And Mick has gone on to had a very successful career working with people like Larry Lujack and Robert Murphy and others as a producer. And now you can actually hear his work as a parody songwriter. I was just talking about Bob Dureau, who wrote all those Schoolhouse Rock songs. But you are like Bob Dureau. You write your own songs that are appearing on a regular basis on the WGN Morning News on Channel 9.
That's right. Me and my buddy Al Flash, every once in a while you hear them talk about something in the news or something we've done for one of the cast members of the show, and they'll say, oh, Mick and Al have a new song for us, and you hear a song and a little video clip, and yeah, we do that as kind of a little side venture to have some fun. Yeah,
very cool. So... and today in the Pop Culture Club, I wanted to talk about a magazine that you and I both grew up reading and enjoying for many years. And that, of course, we were always, and still are, music fans. Although, the older you get, it's harder to be a music fan.
Yeah, it sure is.
And we will be talking about that a little later in this segment as well. But Rolling Stone magazine, which has become an icon unto itself, as I said earlier, first started in San Francisco by Jan Wenner, and really became quickly the voice of the emerging baby boomer, generation, as well as the counterculture that was beginning to develop, thanks to rock and roll, and thanks to the Vietnam War, and thanks to people talking about the environment and people talking about drug use. And so there was just this in the tumultuous 60s, there was a counterculture against the establishment, and Rolling Stone conveniently and wisely filled that gap.
It sure did for a long time.
Yeah, and then I think what happened, though, as with many kind of rebels, what happens is that the counterculture becomes the establishment. The very thing that they were rebelling against, they eventually become. You know?
Yeah.
And so I think what happened with Rolling Stone, I mean, it had a good run. It certainly, when MTV happened and rock music then really became more than just a predicted fad and became established as the music of the generation, and certainly took on a visual aspect, I think Rolling Stone had a pretty good run there. But I would say in the last 15 to 20 years, obviously when the internet came about, many magazines have, the publishing, business in general has been just decimated by the internet, because people can just go online as opposed to, holding this hard copy of a magazine. And I think editorially, Rolling Stone kind of lost its way too. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, it did, and in the magazine itself, and you and I have talked about this before, it even shrunk. I mean, it softened and became less vital. I mean, remember the days when the Rolling Stone interview, they would actually say the Rolling Stone interview with Pete Townsend or Bruce Springsteen or even Madonna or John Lennon, whoever it was, that was a big deal, and it became less of a big deal. And the magazine itself actually shrunk. I remember the last time I saw Rolling Stone on the newsstand, it literally looked like the size of an Archie comic book.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, going back to its early days, and I have many early copies of Rolling Stone just because I have, you know, in my Elton John collection, I've got when Elton was on, you know, the cover, and they covered him in the, you know, in within the magazine in the mid and early 70s. Rolling Stone started out as a thick newspaper, a folded newspaper. It was printed on newspaper. And it was almost like a thick Sun Times, and
right.
Then into the 80s they went away from that, and then they went to a magazine format. It was still oversized, and it was still printed on the same kind of, you know, newspaper print. It was just a lot more color was used, and it was a little oversized. And then in the 90s it got much more glossy. It got a the perfect binding, which didn't have the the staples anymore. It was a perfect bound with just that flat kind of edge, almost like a book, and got much glossier. And the, you know, the layout got bigger. And the other side of the coin, though, aside from the visuals of it, the editorial, as I said before, the editorial side of the magazine began to get a little muddied, because they didn't, you know, all of a sudden, you know, especially in the early 90s, we had the rise of the boy band and of Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, and like pop began to take over.
Right.
And so, you know, here was Rolling Stone. It was always like, you know, the monolith of rock and roll, like you said, the interview. And to be on the cover of Rolling Stone
was a huge deal.
In its heyday, I mean, if you remember, there was a group called Dr. Hook, which even had a song called The Cover of the Rolling Stone. I mean,
right.
That was a big deal. If you were in the music business, your goal was to get on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. And but then it seemed that the magazine itself was kind of not respecting its own image, and people that I felt were kind of unworthy to be on the cover, because it had become such a, you know, just such a staple of pop culture and rock music. I was like, well, wait a minute. Should that person be on the cover of Rolling Stone? Is that, I mean, are we going to hear about this person in 4 weeks?
Right.
You know, you would want a substantial personality and someone that, like you said, Bruce Springsteen or The Who, or somebody that would, that's going to, has been around for a while and is going to be around forever. And Rolling Stone sort of went more with the fads and went with the times. And yes, I understand you want to sell magazines and you got to try to change. But in Rolling Stone's case, if you change too much, then you lose your total identity. And I think that's what kind of happened.
Well, the other thing I remember, you talk about the cover and who was on it. I remember what a huge deal it was. I think it was in 84 when Duran Duran was on the cover, and it said the Fab Five.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Remember that?
Yes,
and that was kind of that start, what you're talking about something that's so popular. I mean, they couldn't ignore Duran Duran, but the outrage after that issue came out, you know, first of all, calling them the Fab Five instead of obviously the Fab Four for the Beatles, but also, what are you putting these, you know, boy band, pretty boys on the cover of this? These guys have nothing to say. There was a lot of backlash, and that was the start of that turn to, like you said, the more popular stuff that was popish and not so much, you know, the soul of the magazine. What it started out with, you know, like I said, with an interview with John Lennon or Robert Plant or Jimmy Page or whomever.
Yeah, and I mean, and don't forget, I mean, you have to remember that, you know, when you look back at the history of Rolling Stone, David Cassidy was on the cover of Rolling Stone. So, you know,
right.
we can't get on our high horse. But he was as much of a pop idol and teen idol as there ever was. But the whole idea of that story was that he was trying to change his image.
Yeah, he was trying to transcend and go to be, quote, the more serious artist, as opposed to, like you said, the softening of the magazine, the softening of, hey, I'm on the cover because I'm a pop sensation.
Exactly. And so, as I said, I think what happened, you know, you could even see, I mean, to be reviewed in Rolling Stone, if you were an album, you know, if you were an artist, I mean, that once again, that was a big deal because everybody, you know, who liked rock music picked up Rolling Stone and read the reviews. And the reviews became, you know, something that you went to read in that magazine the first thing. And some of the most popular, you know, rock critics came out of Rolling Stone. But what happened then is as time went on, you know, all of a sudden the reviews got shorter. They weren't as expansive in terms of really digging down deep into an album. They were very kind of superficial. They were smaller to the point where a couple of months ago, there was one page of reviews, maybe three albums.
I remember when they used to take 5 or 6 pages of the big print or, right. or the big magazine, you know, back in the day, and it would really went into depth of every song of a record and explained what was going on, as opposed to this glossed over version that you talk about now.
Yeah, and that's where, like I said, this wasn't a the decline of the magazine editorially, I believe, did not happen overnight, but it did happen gradually, I would say, over the last 10 or 15 years. And as I said, it really started to hit because, you know, in terms of a rock and roll movement, in terms of a sound, the last big rock and roll push was grunge in the early,
right, the early 90s.
Early
yeah.
to mid-90s. And then, you know, Kurt Cobain died and a lot of those other bands sort of came and went, and while you still have people like Pearl Jam, and now there's a reunited Smashing Pumpkins around, and even though, Stone Temple Pilots, Scott Weiland died, they have a new, singer, so some of the grunge bands from the early 90s are still around, the ones that really had, you know, sold a lot of albums, but then after that, as I said, the boy bands and the pop, the pop divas, and your Mariah Careys, and then gave birth to your Britney Spears, and then your Britney Spears gave birth to Katy Perry, and Katy Perry gave birth to Kelly Clarkson, and then the rise of hip-hop. And suddenly, Rolling Stone, as I said, was always defined because rock and roll was the music of the counterculture. So I guess Jan Wenner could argue, well, Rolling Stone was always about, you know, the counterculture, and rock music may have been its initial soundtrack, and so we're just following the trends of the culture. But, you know, let's be honest, when you think about Rolling Stone, you think about rock music. You don't think about pop music or hip hop music, or even for a while they even put a country issue out.
Oh, they did that, and I even remember when I was still working at US 99 when Shania Twain was on the cover. And again, they followed, hey, she's the biggest thing in not just country music, but in music in general. Let's throw her on the cover. And, of course, Madonna, years before that, same deal. Like I said, Britney Spears and all these different acts. They just said, whoever everybody's talking about, that's who we're going to throw on the cover.
Yeah, and then once again, in its history, in its heyday in the 60s and into throughout the 70s, they also had stories about movie stars too, and they continue to do that, but there was a lot more, it seemed like then as time in the last 10 or 15 years, there was a lot more movie stars on the cover as opposed to
right.
music stars. So they were always kind of grappling with that. And so I was not surprised that, because now Jan Wenner has got to be close into his 70s. I understand his health is not even that good anymore. He's had a heart attack and apparently he's broke a hip or something. So in October, they announced that they were going to sell Rolling Stone, and it was a surprise in one way because, oh my gosh, I mean, you know, for a certain generation, Rolling Stone has always been there, and it was this, this pillar of journalism. And don't forget some of the writers like Hunter S. Thompson.
And P.J. O'Rourke, a lot of people, yeah.
P.J. O'Rourke and Tom Wolfe, who just passed away. So it was kind of like Playboy in that it had a very specific, kind of audience, and it was talking about the culture. It was also a literary magazine. It also was an investigative magazine. It also talked about politics and the environment and that whole thing. Of course, a couple of years ago, you may remember, they got in a lot of trouble because they did a story about a rape case that never that the story was not substantiated.
Oh, yeah, at a college campus, right?
Yeah, and that really hurt their credibility. And so I want to take a quick break here, and then we'll continue with Mick, because then all of a sudden, when they announced that Rolling Stone was going to be sold, that wasn't a surprise, but I got a surprise in the mail just this week.
Okay.
And so we will talk about that on the other side of this break. But before that, let me just say that this week, Chicago's Best is pigging out. From bacon to porchetta, it's Chicago's best pork this Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV. Chicago's best pork. I'm just going to leave it there and just go. We'll be back right after this. Jim Toronto filling in for Nick DiGilio. No switching. Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 720 AM in Chicago. We're in the Pop Culture Club with Mick Kaler. We're talking about Rolling Stone magazine, which, as I said earlier, was announced in October of last year that it was being sold. And it sent a shockwave for a certain generation. I'm sure that people, for instance, producer tonight, Dan Long. Dan, do you ever read Rolling Stone? Do you even care about Rolling Stone?
I read it when I was a little bit younger. I've not been keeping up with it at all, though.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you the truth of this, too, is the only reason that I even get Rolling Stone today, and I've told this story a few times, I still get Rolling Stone. I have been a subscriber since the late 70s. And about 20 years ago now, it's been that long, I got an offer from Rolling Stone for $30 to become a lifetime member. Now, I mean, if you've ever bought a subscription to a magazine, $30 is nothing.
One-time payment, $30?
One time.
Okay.
Yeah, one time. And you know,
they needed a cash grab, so that's what you did.
Yeah, and don't forget, Rolling Stone came out bi-weekly.
Right.
So it was every 2 weeks there was a new issue. So for $30, that was an amazing deal. So I said, sure. And so I've been getting it. I sent the $30 in. So I tell you, if not for getting that deal, I don't think over the last 15 or 20 years I would have renewed my subscription at all. I really don't, because they said the magazine really, as Mick said earlier, not only did it, you know, editorially kind of lose its way, but it wound up being like a regular size magazine and like 62 pages. I mean, you could literally page through that thing in 10 minutes.
Right, between the ads and the shorter articles.
Yeah.
And like you said, less pages. It was nothing. I was stunned when I saw that. I was like, is this some special little featurette? I'm like, no, that's the actual magazine. It's shrunk down to a comic book.
Yeah, so then I was shocked just this week. I was on vacation over Christmas, and so I missed this news that they actually were bought. So in October, it was announced that they were selling the magazine. And I guess they announced right around Christmas, when nobody could even, you know, no one's even paying attention to the news, and news gets buried around Christmas, especially 5 days before Christmas, that they had been purchased. So I had no idea. In fact, I was wondering to myself, geez, I wonder if they're just going to close it down. Obviously, nobody wants it. It's got a strong brand name, but just like Playboy, it just seems irrelevant at this
point.
Right. And so all of a sudden, I go to my mailbox a couple of days ago, and there's this giant magazine, this oversized magazine, very hefty, with a perfect binding. And I'm like, what is this? And I turn it around, and much to my surprise, it's Rolling Stone magazine.
Wow. Who was on the cover?
Well, here we go. Cardi B.
Oh, God.
And her husband, Offset. And Cardi B is pregnant. Her stomach and her whole bottom torso is naked. There's this giant, she got a giant tattoo all over her stomach and her thigh. So you see the side of her butt, and he's kissing her pregnant stomach. And I guess this is supposedly, I mean, ever since Demi Moore did that, how many years ago on Vanity Fair?
On Vanity Fair, the cover, yeah.
Been taking this picture of the pregnant body, but so they have the same logo, but it's not outlined. It's just it's much more sedate. But it has 130, let me see how many, I mean, I couldn't believe this, 136 pages.
Well, they doubled it from what they were shrunk down to.
Yeah, so it's bigger in size. It's kind of an interesting finish. There's on the cover. There's a whole new layout. Many more stories. Many less. Once again, like three music reviews. I mean, it's just amazing how that has just taken a back seat. And so I read, I'm looking through this, and then there is a letter from Jan Wenner explaining everything about our new direction, and he's still sticking around as the editor, but who knows?
But he still has a hand in it somewhat.
Yeah, we'll see, and so do his two of his kids. But I'm just wondering if this new magazine is just the way for the new owners to kind, because apparently this publishing company has a very big profile online, and so I'm wondering if to throw a bone to the old print version, they went out and splurged on this one their first print issue, and
right,
made it into this whole kind of cool glossy big thick thing. So I'm interested to see what the next one's going to look like. And I'm wondering.
So you said Cardi B and Offset were on the cover.
Right.
So there's obviously a very flattering feature interview with them, correct?
Oh, sure, definitely. In fact, Cardi B was just on like maybe a month ago. So she's already been on twice in the last month.
Okay, put that in perspective. I was just watching the other day, the movie Almost Famous was on cable, and I was watching it. And they bring up in the movie, because they talk about Rolling Stone magazine, because that's who the kid in the movie was reporting for,
right,
to meet the band Stillwater, and they talk about how Rolling Stone trashed the first couple of Led Zeppelin albums.
Right.
So you've gone from a magazine that
right,
trashed the first couple of Led Zeppelin albums to Cardi B and Offset, what's his name?
Offset.
Offspent?
Set. Offset.
Oh, Offset. You got them on the cover. That's the change you've made from the early 70s
no
to
kidding.
2018.
Yeah. Well, on the other side of the news, we will continue to talk about Rolling Stone, because there is actually a story in this current issue that might be worth discussing. So we will continue with the pop culture segment after the news. Elton Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 720 a.m. in Chicago. Filling in for Nick DiGilio, be here till 5 a.m. And we are right in the middle of a discussion of the Pop Culture Club with Mick Kaler, and we have been talking about the new, the past, the present, and what may be the future of Rolling Stone magazine. One time a major, major magazine. And don't forget, Rolling Stone Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone became a media and publishing empire. It used to own, I think, Men's Journal as well as Us Weekly.
And they had an outdoor magazine, too.
Yeah, so, as I said before, at one time, Rolling Stone magazine, when it first started, was this little, this kind of small, little, almost independent, ramshackle little magazine, the little engine that could. That suddenly found a voice and found an audience. I mean, talk about timing, and that's what life really is, especially in business. There was a need for a magazine like Rolling Stone in the late to mid 60s as the baby boomer generation began to get older and began to exert its power of thought, but also its consumer power of buying things. And advertisers obviously wanted to reach that group. And so Rolling Stone certainly took advantage of that. And as I said, it really was reflective of the mood and of the thoughts. And rock and roll certainly played a role in that, as well as, film and everything of that era, where you were starting to get a more, liberal-minded, progressive kind of, counterculture that was emerging, especially during the times of the Vietnam War when the protests were going on. So, as I said, Rolling Stone certainly provided a forum and provided a voice for, a growing, generation. But as time goes on, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, Rolling Stone kind of became the establishment. And it's hard to be a rebel when you're in charge.
Well, the one thing I was going to bring up, too, when we were talking about the 80s when we were starting to see this turn to the popular stars that were on the covers of the magazine. One other thing that kind of really put a tinge to Rolling Stone, 1985 was the beginning of Spin magazine. Remember Spin?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And Spin magazine all of a sudden started doing the, quote, cutting-edge artists, and a lot of the acts that they were on the cover were ones that maybe you never heard of again after that, but they were the ones jumping into, as far as, especially with music, with these artists that maybe normally wouldn't get major play or attention, and Spin magazine all of a sudden had more credibility in music than Rolling Stone did.
Well, and certainly to your point, so what happened was, and that's a really good, it's a really good analogy, is that all of a sudden Spin was looking around at the market and saying Rolling Stone is not servicing the rock music of the day anymore.
You know, that's exactly what happened, yeah.
And so they were like, wait a minute, Rolling Stone has become this big, bloated kind of, you know, general, you know, pop culture magazine, and it's lost its way in terms of being the authority and the voice for the emerging alternative rock at that time in the 90s, and whatever music would be coming next. And so they certainly did find a niche very quickly. Even, you remember the magazine Details?
Oh, sure.
Details was another one. It was more of a pop culture-ish and even a little more of a fashion thing, but they also played into the music side, and Details was a trend-setting magazine, as was Spin, and in those mid-90s there, and they really did, have their sights at Rolling Stone, because, as I said, Rolling Stone suddenly became this kind of bloated, lumbering magazine that really didn't know what it wanted to be. Was it a music magazine? Was it a pop culture magazine? Was it a pop magazine? Was it a celebrity magazine? You know, I think it's lost its way for a good 20 years since then, and it really, in the last 10 or 15, really lost its identity. So I'm going to be interested to see now, as I said, I want to see what the next issue is. This new issue, the first one of the new ownership. And I had to laugh because the name of the new owners is the Penske Media Group.
The Penskes. The Penskes. Are you Penske material?
Yeah, Mr. Wenner, you are not Penske material.
I have the Penske file right here.
Yeah, I have the Penske file. You didn't do anything this well. I mean, it was a big file. I did change it into the accordion size folder.
Sure.
But according, you know, on right at the beginning, there is a letter from Jan Wenner that says the new era for Rolling Stone. It says, "Welcome to the new Rolling Stone. As you can see, we've significantly evolved the magazine into a larger format that will publish monthly rather than biweekly."
So, okay, so you're going to get 12 issues.
Yeah, so now it's going to be less than that. "What isn't changing is our commitment to the integrity, honesty, and quality of our journalism and to our tradition of bold, clean design and original photography. It is our intention to continue that tradition as long as we exist." Now, that's a key thing, as long as we exist. That's an interesting line. As I said, I wonder in the long term, if this company didn't buy Rolling Stone for the brand, you know, they could sell T-shirts with the logo on it. They can have an online presence. But in today's publishing world, it costs so much money in printing costs. I mean, this one issue with 136 pages and the oversized size and the perfect binding and the photography and all the color, this magazine, this issue cost a heck of a lot of money to create. And I don't care if there's only 12 issues from now on. I don't know in today's publishing world if you can afford to do that. So I wonder what the next issue is going to be like. And I wonder if Rolling Stone as an entity, as a brand, as a magazine online, it may exist. But I wonder if the print magazine is eventually going to go by the wayside.
Well, I think you'll know if the next cover of Rolling Stone, you have the Kardashians on the cover.
Yeah, well, and the funny thing is, as I've said a few times as well, so when I get this this lifetime subscription that I was offered about 20 years ago for like $30, how do you turn that down? The one thing that now I wonder, you know, I have to change my thinking. as everybody knows, when you get a subscription to a magazine, if you look at all, you know, there's all those numbers and all those letters, you know, above your name. And usually you can tell that when your subscription is up.
Right. You'll see a date, you know, numbers for the date,
yeah,
the year,
it says
and all
like
that.
The month and then, like, you know, two numbers for the year. So, as I told you, I got a lifetime subscription. So one day, soon after I got this new subscription for a lifetime, I happened to just be looking at the mailing label, and I saw that it said August, and it said 59. And I said, well, wait a minute. Rolling Stone doesn't think, in their minds, by 2059, they're stopping my subscription. Now, don't forget, I have a lifetime subscription.
Right.
So
maybe they're looking at your life expectancy.
Yeah, so they're saying, well, Jim, in 2059, your lifetime subscription, we will not be filling because you won't be around to receive it. So for many years, I mean, that was, first of all, it was a little shocking when you actually see the date.
Yeah, that was, you know, when it's going to end for you, right?
Your demise, which, we know, I mean, we don't know this, but so then my joke was, I am determined to outlive Rolling Stone's prediction.
In fact, so that way you can demand more of your magazine.
Right. So in 2060, I'm calling up Rolling Stone, or even in September or October of 2059, when I'm 89 years old, and I'm going to call them up and say, hey, where's my issue? But now it looks like I'm going to outlive Rolling Stone.
It could happen, yeah.
I was worried about, you know, Rolling Stone outliving me. But given the current state of the magazine, as well as the publishing world, I think I'm going to outlive Rolling Stone.
I think you're covered there, pal.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing I wanted to bring up, too, when you were quoting the Jan Wenner statement that he made, he mentioned photography.
Right.
How can we forget the photography of an Annie Leibovitz?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Annie Leibovitz, who has gone on to be one of the most popular magazine, as well as just any kind of photographers, but certainly the pop culture and entertainment photographers, and her work now appears regularly in Vanity Fair and other magazines. She was just some like 20-year-old college student,
a groupie with a camera,
yeah, who sort of walked into, once again, I mean, the beginnings of Rolling Stone. It was just a ramshackle kind of a magazine, a few little offices, and it was just like a party more than a frat than it was a business. And she sort of walked in, and Jan said, "Yeah, we'll go to this concert here." And suddenly, he basically, started her career. And when you talk about the great magazine, I mean, that's the thing about Rolling Stone. I don't want to, just push it aside, because in its day, it was really an important magazine. And to your point, from the photography, from the journalistic side, as I said, there were writers like Hunter S. Thompson and Tom Wolfe. And as I said, you had the Rolling Stone interview. Those Rolling Stone interviews used to be like 7 or 8 pages, and they would spend 2 or 3 weeks with the person, living with them, and you'd get this background information and this behind-the-scenes information that you couldn't get anywhere else.
Yeah, it was a major deal where you get these little inside stories, because, like you said, the journalist and the photographer would just basically live with these guys, whether or women, on tour or in their personal lives, etc.
And there were some great photos of Bob Dylan and John Lennon, and of course, I think what has been voted maybe the best cover, not only of Rolling Stone but perhaps of any magazine, I believe, is the chilling and sad picture of, on the day that John Lennon was killed, Annie Leibovitz.
Yeah, the picture of John and Yoko.
Yeah, Annie Leibovitz went to the Dakota where they lived, and they took this photo of John, who was naked, and Yoko was fully dressed, and they were both laying down, and he was kind of in the fetal position hugging her. And that was printed then after, because it was shot on the day that he was killed. And obviously, a couple of weeks later, the next issue, that was the cover. And I believe that photo may have been voted, if not the best cover of Rolling Stone, one of the best covers of any magazine of all time.
And the other part about those cover shots, and they had unusual ones. I remember there was one of Whoopi Goldberg in a giant bathtub full of
milk.
And
exactly.
There were all sorts of different, creative expressions. It wasn't just a quick picture. There is a whole book, I have it, of famous Rolling Stone covers.
Oh, definitely. So, like I said, Rolling Stone, I don't want to make it sound as if, oh, it's just this this magazine that's been irrelevant for a while. There is no question. And I ultimately, what I have to say about Rolling Stone at the end of the day is you cannot deny the impact and the influence of Rolling Stone magazine.
It has major heritage,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, it played its role, but you know, but I when I say it lost its relevance, what I mean by that is, and it's not really you know, it's not even a cut against it or something bad about it. It's not a criticism. It's just that it was an idea for its time, and it certainly, as I said earlier, you know, it filled a need. But maybe 50 years on, you know, that just isn't relevant anymore. That idea isn't needed. That void isn't there anymore. And so maybe it's okay to just say, you know what? It's time to go away. The world doesn't always have to have a Rolling Stone magazine. It had a Rolling Stone magazine when it needed and wanted a Rolling Stone magazine. But maybe now, 50 years later, there's just no need for it and people don't want it.
And again, it's quite possible that you're right about that. I was just thinking as you were talking about that. I was thinking the other day because I had a friend who used to work at a photomat. Remember photomat?
Exactly. Yeah, they had a little hut like in a parking lot
where you would drop off your film to be developed.
Right.
Okay. How many photomats are left now?
Well, how much film is left? Forget about photo,
that's exactly,
man.
It. And even though there is still music and it's still a vibrant thing into a lot of people's lives, it's so spread out. And again, the reporting of it can be done by anybody who's got an internet access and post up whatever they want. All of a sudden, the influence and the importance of a Rolling Stone magazine goes by the wayside.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. There are certain cars that at one time were very popular. They don't make that model anymore. This happens. It's just the natural course of evolution. And so I understand if you're a Jan Wenner, this has been your life, and you want to see it go on. But maybe it's just its time is past, and instead of keeping it on life support, maybe it's just thank you and good night.
Yeah, it could very well be that. Well, it'll be interesting to see, like I said, what your next few magazine covers are going to look like every month when you get your new issue.
I'm certainly interested in seeing that. We're going to continue to talk because just as we say about how irrelevant Rolling Stone magazine is, there's a story in here that's actually worth talking about.
I know. As soon as I saw that online, I was like, hey, we got to talk about this, even though we're not sure how much impact it has on our lives.
So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Mick Kaler and the Pop Culture Club. I'm Jim Toronto filling in for Nick DiGilio. It's about 2:50 a.m. We'll be back after this. No switching. Jim Toronto with you at WGN, 7:20 a.m. in Chicago, filling in for Nick DiGilio. Be here till 5 a.m. Then we will pass it on to the opening bell, and then Justin Kaufman fills in for Steve Cochran today, and I believe probably tomorrow as well, too, right, on Friday. So that's the game plan. But right now we are talking to Mick Kaler about Rolling Stone magazine, and I just got a text which makes a really good point here, Mick. I thought I would bring this up.
Mm-hmm.
He mentions, I don't know if it's he or she, I shouldn't say that, but thanks for the text, 815. 815 texts and says, Mad Magazine was another magazine that was a binding figure of the past era, and that is true, too. And look at that, Mad Magazine, for that era in the mid-60s and early 70s, I mean, Mad Magazine was one of those magazines. It was iconic.
That was the first magazine outside of, like, Archie Comics that I read when I was, like, 9 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it was Mad Magazine was this magazine of that was just this hilarious, you know, it was a kind of off the middle road of jokes and comedy.
Great parodies.
Parodies of movies, parodies of things. Alfred E. Newman, What Me Worry, became the face. It was an iconic figure. And yeah, I mean, it was kids of, like, to your point, young kids as well as teenagers and people in their 20s and 30s would all pick up Mad Magazine.
Yeah, and I went from Archie Comics to Mad Magazine, and then besides Rolling Stone, there was National Lampoon.
Right, exactly, the same thing. Remember Cracked?
Oh, sure, Cracked was like a magazine like Mad. It was kind of like an imitator of it and did the same thing that Mad did.
Yeah, it was an offshoot of that, but now once again, you know, do you hear people talking about Mad Magazine? I mean, I, at home, at my house, I have a little statue of Alfred E. Newman.
There you go.
On display, where his hand's out, and it says, what, me worry? I mean, you know, it's a classic, you know, pop culture, you know, figure. But as I said, just like Rolling Stone, you know, in today's world, did Mad Magazine doesn't have the impact or the relevance that it once did. And so, and that's okay. You know, as I said, I mean, it had its moment. I mean, how, you know, just think about what it, you know, the odds of a magazine like Rolling Stone or Mad Magazine ever becoming, or like you said, National Lampoon, ever becoming a huge success. And yet it was. So that is enough sometimes.
And to put it in modern day perspective with, again, like, say, a Mad Magazine with their, that they might lampoon or make fun of a current movie or a current president or whatever. Nowadays, with Photoshop and all the things you can do online, you know, what they took a week or a month to do for their magazine, you can do that in about 15 seconds and post it up on Facebook, and everybody sees it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, ultimately, what happened, the Internet, the great irony of the Internet, and this goes back into the mid-90s when it first began, you know, taking hold. The irony is that the Internet and its ability to is the urgency and the immediacy.
Yeah.
So the funny thing is that the people that were promoting the Internet initially to the public was the newspaper and magazine people, saying, because they were news junkies, they were information junkies. And so they were all hyped up because this new tool provided fast access to information. So newspapers and magazines started writing about the Internet and, like, hey, this Internet is cool, and look what you could do. And unknowingly, they set up their own demise.
Right.
Because they promoted the Internet so much in stories, in the newspapers and in magazines, that everybody said, well, let me take a look at this. And then all of a sudden, the Internet started to provide that immediacy that, I mean, don't forget, a newspaper, as soon as the ink hits the paper, the newspaper is irrelevant, because something can happen in the next 5 minutes that the Internet can tell you about, and the newspaper is now, it seems like it's 40 years in the past. As soon as that ink hits the paper, it's done.
And now we live in this 24-hour news cycle, where it's even, I consider it a 12-hour news cycle nowadays, with the immediacy of cable and Internet and all that. That things have changed.
And the same thing, like you said, so like a magazine like Rolling Stone, every day if you go on Yahoo, you go on any kind of search engine, there's all these stories about celebrities and what's happening this minute and who tweeted this and who did that and pictures of this and pictures of that. So how can a magazine like Rolling Stone, that's trying to be cutting edge, it can't break news anymore?
No, and it can't. Like I said, the immediacy is lost. And everybody's on top of it. It's funny, because even a few years ago when I stopped buying People magazine, I stopped because every time I'd get an issue, I'd get it at the Jewel, you know, I get my groceries and all that, I pick up the new People magazine, and I'd thumb through it. I'd be like, I read that story,
exactly.
Already saw that online, saw that on the news, done that, and it's like, there's nothing here that's new that I need to know.
Yeah, so after the news, Mick's going to stick around. Can you stick around, Mick?
Where else am I going at this time of the night, bud?
Me too. We are going to talk about a story in the new current issue of Rolling Stone, the 100 greatest songs of the century, .. so far. So I thought it was interesting, because we can not only talk about what we think about some of these songs in this list, but we can also talk about how we don't know most of these songs.
We are totally on hip, and I'm happy with it, bud.
Trying to make me go to rehab. Jim Toronto with you here at WGN, 720 AM in Chicago. Filling in for Nick DiGilio. We'll be here another couple hours or so till 5 o'clock. We'll hand it off to the opening bell. And then at 6 o'clock, Justin Kaufman fills in for Steve Cochran this morning on July 5th. Thank you for listening. Hope you will continue the ride with us until 5. And if this is your regular spot to listen to the radio, then and you like what you're hearing tonight, and you like what you heard yesterday, then climb on board for one more, because I'll be filling in for Nick DiGilio tomorrow morning from 1 to 5 a.m. So I hope you will continue to stay with me right now until 5, and I hope you'll be around tomorrow from 1 to 5. I think you're going to like it, especially in the wake of all this hot weather that we're having. Let me just say that I think tomorrow's show may be refreshing, and I'll leave it at that. That'll be the tease for you to come back tomorrow at 1 a.m. here at WGN. But right now, I'm talking to Mick Kaler in the Pop Culture Club, and we're talking about Rolling Stone magazine as it begins its new era. It was recently sold, and a new company bought it back in December, and it just printed its new or first edition, first issue, under its new ownership. And as I said, we will see the magazine world and printing and publishing in general has been just decimated by the internet over the last 20 years. Look at newspapers, as well as some of your favorite magazines have gone by the wayside, or certainly have become mere shadows of what they used to be. But at the same time, as Mick and I were just talking about the demise of Rolling Stone over the last 20 years, and especially who knows what its future may be, despite having a new owner, when I look in the latest issue, I see a story that is interesting and worth talking about.
Thank God for that.
Yeah. So this is an interesting topic, and they've done this at least online. They do have a strong online presence, as I said. The new owner of Rolling Stone. So we'll see if they continue to push more things online. I saw a story that they did recently about the top 50 albums, the best 50 albums of 2018 so far. So they seem to be on this kind of kick about the so far stuff.
Right.
Because this story is a fairly big story in the magazine, the print issue. The 100 greatest songs of the century, ... so far.
And we're 18 years in.
18 years in, which I mentioned this yesterday. I mean, we're almost one-fifth done with this century.
It's gone fast.
I mean, I remember the year 2000, New Year's Eve, when we went from 99 to 2000. Even though I know officially the new century didn't start until 2001, or 2001, as I say. I'm tired of hearing the 2000s. You know, by the way, you'll notice, I always say 2018. We're done with the 2018. You don't say that anymore. When it was in the 1970s, did you say 1972?
No, you just said 1975,
yeah,
1990.
So why do we keep saying 2018, or which it's 2018, 1972, 2018. We never said, oh, it's now 1984. No, it was 1984. So enough of that 2000 stuff. We're over that. I could see at the beginning when there was a lot of zeros, it didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's 2018, it's 2019, it's 2020, it's 2017. That's it. Ugh, enough of that. So I played Rehab, which is on the list, and Rolling Stone's top 100 songs of the century.
Amy Winehouse, sure.
So far. So that one, Amy Winehouse's Rehab, came in at number 20. And as I'm looking at this list, there's two things struck me. I guess it was just my own kind of culture shock when you see just how many, how dominant at this point hip hop is. It is the music of the time. There's no question.
Oh, absolutely. The way rock was in the 60s and 70s, it's definitely hip hop now.
Yeah, I mean, rock and roll I love rock and roll, and that's my music. Don't get me wrong. But sadly, I have to say that in its current state and where it continues to go, I would say another 5, 10, maybe on the outside 15 years, and if you're lucky, 20 years, but I don't think it's going to be 20 years. I think it's going to be much sooner than that. I think rock and roll ultimately is going to be relegated to a niche kind of music like jazz or big band music, which was once the dominant music of the day for many decades, and then it went away.
And, I think rock's going to fade out like that, too. And I don't hope for that, but it's just the way we see things happening.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go away because I think, you know, I mean, we have to also realize, too, I don't think this is just an opinion. I think there's facts to back this up. I believe when they start to write the history books, and we're almost, 50 years now past, say, the, 60 years since Elvis and 50 years since the Beatles came on the scene, more than that now. So we certainly can start writing those history books, but I think you really have to look at the 50s and certainly the 60s and mid to late 70s. That was a renaissance time for popular music. And, you know, just like in Italy, when there was Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, and there was the Renaissance there, that was an incredibly creative time when those people were doing their thing, just like when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Who and all these other bands, and rock and roll was just dominant. And, you know, after da Vinci and all those people, there were artists right after them, and they were popular. And people went to see their works, and everybody made a big deal about them, but they weren't like the masters.
Yeah, the golden era of rock was definitely that time you're talking about.
Yeah, and so I hate to say it, but I don't see how rock and roll can ever. I mean, I know that there's people that are keeping their fingers crossed, but I just don't think it's going to come back because here's something that I think really at least hit home for me. The other day I saw a commercial. I've never seen this before. I saw a commercial for a guitar at Guitar Centers on television.
Wow.
Because, before, I don't think guitar shops and a place like Guitar Center ever had to advertise because they just had this natural audience of kids growing up wanting to play the guitar.
Right, wanting to have a garage band, wanting to get a bunch of guys together and make music. And that's kind of a foreign thing now.
Yeah, and so because now everything is with beats, everything's done electronically, technology-wise. You know, hip hop. You know, most of the hip hop artists don't play an instrument at all.
Well, my favorite thing is the popularity of DJs who show up in front of tens of thousands of people with pre-recorded stuff.
Yeah, with an iPod.
Yeah, here you go. I'm here. I'm going to push a button. Now jam.
And I'm going to wear a mouse head.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, so when I saw this commercial for a Les Paul guitar, $3,500 at your local Guitar Center, I said, "Wow, they must be hurting when they start," because I've never seen Guitar Center, advertised on television.
No, everyone knew that's where you had to go, and that's what you aspired to do. Now they're looking for this niche audience of people that say, hey, I want to learn how to play the guitar. Again, as you said, in modern music, who knows what a guitar is anymore?
Yeah, so there once again, there's a huge shift in music and a musical taste. And as like I said, as much as I love rock and roll, here's the hard reality of it, folks, and we'd love for these people to live forever. But, Paul McCartney, I think, is 76 or 77 years old.
Yeah, Roger Daltrey's like 74.
Yeah, Elton John, my favorite, is 71. Bruce Springsteen is 68. All these classic rock artists are now in their late 60s, early 70s, if not late 70s, and almost 80. I mean, I went to Los Angeles a couple weeks ago. I saw Rod Stewart and Cyndi Lauper. Cyndi Lauper is 65 years old.
Yeah.
Cyndi Lauper.
Remember when she was just a little girl?
Yeah. Who just wanted to have fun.
Yeah.
And now she's 65. Now it's old ladies just want to have fun.
Geriatric.
Yeah. I mean,
menopause.
And so I was like, my gosh, if Cyndi Lauper is 65 and there's Rod Stewart, 73, still singing about, do you think I'm sexy? If you want my body.
Grandpa, sit down, please.
Yeah. So here, but the reality of the situation, as much as we don't want to maybe face it, is within the next 10 or 15 years, the reality is that many of the remaining classic rock stars are going to be either gone or probably not able to. Look at Neil Diamond. He has to, you know, quit performing because of Parkinson's disease. You know, age hits everybody, and, you know, Mick Jagger is in his mid-70s. So, I mean, it'd be great if Paul McCartney lived to be 95, but even if he did, could he still play and sing?
Well, and the other part of that is, you're talking about these classic rock artists, there is nobody following behind, you know, a Paul McCartney, a Bruce Springsteen, an Elton John in the rock genre to say, okay, now we're filling in. I mean, like, you had early rock pioneers like Elvis and Chuck Berry, et cetera, and then the Beatles came, and then, you know, The Who came, and Springsteen, and all that stuff. And there were people coming back to fill up those ranks. Okay, Elvis is dead, but guess what? We have Bruce Springsteen, or we have this artist or that artist. There is nobody coming back, with the exception of maybe Pearl Jam, but Pearl Jam's a classic rock artist now.
Yeah, I mean, so as I said, I really, it's sad to say it, but when that crop of people passes away, and they're still touring because there's still a demand, but there is going to come a time when either their age is going to prevent them from performing anymore, or, you know, the natural evolution of life is they're just going to pass away. And when they are gone, while their music will still be played, it will not have the impact, I believe, that, you know, that it will have with them still around. And as I said, you know, you still talk about John Coltrane, and you still talk about Miles Davis, but I use them as examples of jazz, but it's a small niche, and I think there's going to come a time, you know, you talk to people, my godson is in his mid-30s, and I mentioned some people, and he doesn't know who some of these people are.
Yeah.
And in my mind, it's like, oh my gosh, these are the Mount Rushmore of music. And he
looks, these are automatics. You know, everyone would know if you're into that music.
Yeah, and he looks at me like, oh, I've heard of them. So,
well, it's funny you mentioned that I've heard of them line, Jim, because when I looked at that list of Rolling Stone of the top 100 songs, you know, so far of the century, I don't know many of those songs. I've heard of some of those artists.
Right.
I've heard the names. I've heard of Outkast, and I think I've seen them on SNL. I couldn't name you one of their songs, but I didn't know many of the song titles at all.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I mean, that was kind of the chilling thing for me, was I went through the top 100, and I said, to your point, yeah, I know who Taylor Swift is. Yeah, I know who Gnarls Barkley is. I know who Adele is. I know who Lorde is. You know, I know who Kanye West is. I know who Britney Spears is, as I'm looking at this list. I know who, Bruno Mars is. I know who Rihanna is. I know who Lady Gaga is, but...
Yeah, you know, their pictures or their personas.
Yeah, but I know who Daft Punk is, but I don't know if I could list 17 of their songs.
Or could you even hum one?
No, and I was like, I'm reading this going... Wow. I mean, and I'm somebody who still listens to the radio, still reads these magazines, you know, and still keeps up. And yet I think it's just the natural, once again, the natural evolution of music. And, you know, once again, I will admittedly say I am not into hip hop or rap music. I wasn't into it. And if he said, oh, well, you know, you're too old for it. No, no. Listen, gang, I was 24 years old or 20. I was 23 or 22. When Run DMC and Beastie Boys and all that were all coming up in the rap genre, and they started to establish rap music, I was in my early 20s. I certainly could have jumped on that bandwagon. I just
didn't. And I was only a couple years older than you, am, but it's like
it wasn't the same thing.
I'm like, okay, I'm around for this to happen. I remember when Run DMC jammed with Aerosmith for Walk This Way.
Right.
And I was like, okay, that's okay. And then I didn't climb on after that because I didn't like it. It wasn't for me. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it wasn't. It's not an age thing, because I was right in the sweet spot of when that was up and coming and beginning to take hold. And so I certainly, if I liked that music, I would have liked it. It just wasn't my cup of tea. I do like a melody. I do like a good lyric. I do like a song about something and not just yelling at one each other and having these feuds or whatever it is. And I'm not putting it down, but that's what the genre is. And so it didn't appeal to me when I was 22, and it's not appealing to me now. And like I said, that's okay. I'm not feeling weird about it, but to say, oh, well, you don't like it just because of your age. No, I was there when it started. And it wasn't my cup of tea then. But so what do you think was number one? You saw the story. So Crazy in Love with Everybody Loves Beyonce.
Beyonce, sure.
We love Beyonce. I mean, Beyonce is now a feminist role model, but my gosh, she is the artist of this generation.
She can do no wrong, and neither can her husband Jay-Z.
Yeah, so they had the top 100 best songs. I'll just give you a few here. So, "Crazy in Love" by Beyonce featuring Jay-Z was number one. "Paper Planes" by MIA. I never heard it. I don't know what that is.
I've heard of MIA, but I don't know the song.
Outkast was number four. La Face. I've heard of this one. I've heard of this one. I heard Jay-Z's 99 Problems. I've heard that. And I've heard Rolling in the Deep. That's number eight by Adele.
By Adele, right.
I've heard Royals.
And by the way, in fairness, Adele's had other great songs, but Rolling in the Deep is probably her best. But she could have had three or four songs on that list.
Yeah, I've heard of Royals by Lorde. But
yeah.
I never heard of Runaway. I know who Kanye West is, obviously. Maps by the Ya Ya Ya's. Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes. I was never a big... Were you a big White Stripes fan?
No, not really.
Yeah, everybody talks about Jack White. I think it was that they were looking for somebody to be the next big thing, and I never got into White Stripes.
The only thing I liked about Jack White was when he did the collaboration with Loretta Lynn.
Yeah.
And it's like, people are like, who's Loretta Lynn?
But so go on there. If you know, I mean, once again, Britney Spears is here and Gnarls Barkley. I mean, obviously, Crazy. That was a big song. David Bowie's last song, Black Star, is in there. The Strokes, which is interesting. There's you know, Taylor Swift. You know, there's a Bob Dylan song, which is kind of just obligatory. That doesn't deserve to be there. You know, Eminem, you know, Stan, which I know that one. I have, obviously, Pharrell Williams with Happy. So, I mean, there's obviously, I mean, I know some of these songs. You know, Green Day's American Idiot.
But it's funny you mentioned American Idiot because, again, first of all, Green Day, when I saw that, I got excited. Cause like, oh, here's a song I know, and I like that whole album, and I like that group. And I started then looking at the songs that, not just the artists, but the songs I knew, and American Idiot was one of them. And I'm like, why do I like that? Because it reminds me of when I was growing up, the kind of rock I listened to, you know, and they were kind of more Ramones-like, but of course I loved the Ramones. When I looked at pop songs that they had Teenage Dream by Katy Perry. I really enjoy that song, but it reminds me of my era, you know, our era when we were growing up. The pop sensibilities of a song like that made sense, and it's one that I know very well.
Yeah, well, we'll see now. The century is one almost one-fifth over, so we'll see how that that list changes if Rolling Stone is around by the end of the century.
and if you outlive the magazine subscription.
Exactly, exactly. I want to thank Mick Kaler for joining me this morning. Thanks for staying up, Mick. And
my pleasure, pal.
We will talk again soon. Take care.
All right, man.
All right. Mick Kaler.